Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the award-winning poet and novelist Marge Piercy. Piercy is the author of 16 novels, including the New York Times bestseller Gone to Soldiers and the classic Woman on the Edge of Time. In addition, she's published 17 collections of poetry, including To Be of Use, Circles on Water, and My Mother's Body. In 2002, she wrote a very stirring and powerful memoir called Sleeping with Cats. Her most recently published works are the historical novel Sex Wars, about the post-Civil War period, and a collection of poetry published last year called The Crooked Inheritance. I'm speaking to Marge Piercy by phone from her home in Wellfleet, Massachusetts. Welcome to the show, Marge Piercy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, I want to talk about the fact that you had a volatile relationship with your mother, but you credit her for helping you to become a poet. Can you talk a little bit about that relationship and how she influenced you as a writer?
My mother was a woman who believed in paying attention. She believed that you should be observant. Now, I think she was training me. She wanted me to be, you know, observant in, I don't know what she was thinking of, most journalists. In getting me to pay very close attention to things, she really made me a poet by accident.
That's very interesting. And did some of the volatile part of your relationship also make you want to speak out?
The volatility came in as I think when I reached puberty. I think that was kind of unendurable for her. Her life had been so difficult that somehow when I was a little girl, that was okay. But when I became a teenager, that wasn't okay.
Mm-hmm. And in your 1985 collection, My Mother's Body, you have this wonderful last line in the poem of the same name called, "What you did not dare in your life, you dare in mine," which I found incredibly moving.
Well, I think that my mother was a woman who was given so little, who got so little in her life. I've always had that sense that she had great potentiality, but she had to leave school halfway through 10th grade to help support her family. She never really had love. She never had much comfort. She never had much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it comes through in your poetry. Now, I also want to talk about the fact that your early poetry had an assertiveness and an anger and an honesty in talking about your life as a woman that many people had never heard before. Now, what was the emerging feminist movement one of the reasons that why you were able to bring this voice center stage?
I think so, absolutely. I felt I had very much a sense of constituency then, very much a sense of speaking for a lot of other women. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a rather marvelous time in which there was relatively little competition and a lot of cooperation.
And did you ever stop yourself and say, I better not say this? Did you ever censor yourself during those days? Because it was
pretty maverick.
I never
censor myself.
Never have, huh?
No, and you might as well bring it all out. My experience is that the poems that might frighten you the most, you write them saying, well, I don't have to publish this. And you work on it and work on it. And then you do publish it. And then you discover that there are many other people who speak the same way. There's a very honest poem I read about my father after his death about the lack of love between us and the difficulties of the relationship and how it strengthened me. And I was very hesitant to read that poem to audiences, but I discovered every time I did, sometimes people cried. Always men or women came up afterwards and said, "That's what happened with me." So when you write about the things that you most fear to write about, often they speak for other people too.
Mm-hmm. And it must be a cathartic experience for you as well, just personally.
I don't know.
Really?
When you're writing poems, it isn't personal. Mm. Even if you're dealing with very, very personal stuff, it isn't personal. You're creating an artifact. Your stuff is just stuff to work with.
Wow, that's an interesting way of thinking about it.
I think that's when you're really concentrating and really working, you approach a state in which there's very little ego involved.
Wow, because so many women poets, especially in the early days, were accused of just doing personal, gushing poetry and so on. And yours has always been more political than that.
I don't make a distinction.
Really?
Politics is part of life. If I might write a poem about multiflora roses in bloom, I might write a love poem, I might write a political poem. It's all one piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you really have made the personal political and vice versa. It's quite remarkable. Now, I want to have you read a poem from your current collection. It's called Deadlocked Wedlock, and can you just tell us a little bit about it?
I've read this all over states that were contemplating banning, defining marriage as between a man and a woman. Of course, I live in Massachusetts.
Yes, a maverick state.
Yeah, where my lesbian friends get to spend just as much stupid money as heterosexual couples on weddings. I went to a wonderful wedding on the beach where the dogs came, both couples, both women. Deadlocked wedlock. Marriage is one man and one woman, they say, one at a time, then another, another. You see in the buff faces of old men shining with money as they leave their young blondes and toddlers, second or third families. The shop-worn wives donated to Goodwill. It has always been so, they say, one man and one woman in the Bible, like Jacob with Leah and Rachel and the two bondmaidens dropping children, his four women competing to swell like a galaxy of moons. In Tibet, women had various husbands at once. I had two myself for a few years. In earlier times, in different cultures and tribes, men married men and women married women, and the sky never fell. People loved as they would and must, and the rivers still ran clean, and the grass grew a lot harder and more abundantly than it does for us. What damage does love do in the soft gray evenings? When the rain drifts like pigeon feathers across the sky and into the trees? Why, gentlemen, do you fear two women who walk holding hands with their child? Two 50-year-old men exchange rings and kiss, and you catch mad cow disease as fallout. What do you hate when you watch lovers? What are you really missing?
That's great, Marge. That's great. You're able to take a subject that makes so many people angry and make it really quite beautiful.
I think it is beautiful when people find a partner.
Mm-hmm. Me too. But the political issue has stirred so much hatred.
So much anger, so much hatred.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about the fact that you're one of the few writers who's actually pulled off quality poetry and fiction in your career. Now, do you have two separate relationships with these very different mediums? How do you deal with them?
They are very different. Poetry is much more immediate. It comes out of the newspapers, the media, friends' lives, my own life, everything that happens. And it may take you a long time to finish a poem about something, but things constantly want to turn into poems. Fiction is much more like moving into a new house or apartment. You're going to live with it for 2 or 3 years, and it's much more about other people's lives. It's about time and the choices people make and how they work out through time, the good and bad choices, what it means in a particular socioeconomic and political context.
Would you say poetry is more intimate?
Yeah.
And are you able to distill more of your soul in poetry, or can you do the same in fiction?
Fiction is generally not about myself.
Uh-huh.
Fiction, the two requirements, I think, for writing the kind of fiction I write are empathy and imagination. And a lot of it's being able to enter other people's lives and get into them and imagine them from the inside.
Now, I want to talk about the fact that in 2002 you published a particularly bold and intimate memoir called Sleeping with Cats. Now, so much of your poetry, like we were just saying, has been autobiographical. Well, why did you feel you needed to write a memoir at that point in time?
Well, poetry, it you can't really tell the difference between what's personal and what comes from other lives or newspapers or whatever. I wrote it when I had turned 65, and I felt it was time to sort of take stock of my life.
And that's the reason why you decided to do that at that
point. Yeah.
Was it like a gift to yourself?
It was a stock taking thing. I wouldn't call it a gift. It's more like I'm a Jew, so on at Rosh Hashanah you think about what you've done in the year and between the days of awe. Well, this was like a massive self-examination, and I discovered I hadn't been nearly as good a person as I thought I was.
And did you hold anything back, or because it seems so incredibly peeling of the skin and honest and bare?
It is a book mostly about my personal relationships.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff that isn't in that. My husband Woody says that when I'm near death, I should write a book called Things Unsaid.
Things I only
read about.
To the cats. Huh? Wow. Now, you do have a really intimate relationship with cats. Tell us why they have grabbed your heart and soul through your whole life.
Well, the cats they're such strong personalities. They're so sensual and sensitive and responsive. And they're these little strong beings that aren't us, but you live with is as close to wildness as you're likely to get in your house.
And do they help you write?
No. In fact, sometimes if they're feeling, one of them will get beside me and grab my elbow when I'm at the computer. One of the others will get between me and the screen and walk back and forth.
Are they trying to tell you to cool it?
Yeah, they say, come on, you've been here long enough. Come and pay attention to us. Play with us. Feed us. Do something.
Get out in the world. Yeah, out in the world so you'll have something more to write about. Now, it's obvious from your novels as well as your poetry that you've always been an incredibly political being. So a lot of people have told artists that they should stay away from politics, but you certainly don't feel that way.
It's a 20th century heresy that poetry can't be political. Try telling that to any of the Greek or Roman writers. Try telling that to Byron or Shelley. Try telling it to Wordsworth. Try telling it to anybody who wrote, to Blake, you know?
I agree.
Poets.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
Oh, it is.
We're citizens like anybody else. We have the same responsibilities. The same things happen to us. A whole generation of Jewish poets went up in smoke.
Yes, yes.
You live in the world, and what goes on in the world impacts on you. If the air is polluted, you breathe the same air as everybody else. When the country is being impoverished by a stupid war, Your taxes go to pay for that war. You have the same responsibilities as anybody else.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the award-winning poet and novelist Marge Piercy. Now, you've had a really successful career, but do you feel still that you create from the vantage point of a working-class person?
Yeah, I'm not middle class. The middle-class women sometimes have trouble with me. Because I'm not a lady.
Well, we can tell by your poetry that you don't really need to be.
Well, sometimes a disadvantage.
But in regard to your writing, did you still see the world through the eyes of a looking class person as well, regardless of the way people react to you?
Partly, yeah.
In what ways?
I always look at who benefits from things, who pays for them, and who gets to choose that they happen.
So that's you being aware of the fact that everything costs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that the cost is usually not borne by those who get the advantage of it and who choose that it happens.
Now, I want to talk about, just briefly, about many of your novels, like Gone to Soldiers and the most recent Sex Wars, are about particular historical times and places. How do you get interested in these particular times?
I had wanted to write about Elizabeth Cady Stanton for a number of years because she isn't as nearly as famous as Susan B. Anthony, but she's much more interesting to me.
Mm.
I think she was more radical. I think she had a much broader perspective. And her life was much richer in emotional terms. So she was interesting to me, but I had never seen how to write about her. And then after the fraudulent election of 2000, where the vote was stolen in Florida.
Yes, yes, we remember it well.
I remembered that that had happened before. With the Rutherford Hayes election. So I just did a little research on that, and then I began running across things about the time that were so parallel. And what fascinated me was how many of the hot-button issues of that time are the same as now. The big issues of the day right after the Civil War were abortion, contraception, the rights of women and minorities, immigration, the economy, should Christianity be the official religion, should the Bible be taught in schools, censorship, election fraud, pornography. So it seemed obvious that one should write about that time.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Just one.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you were able to tie all that stuff in that novel. It's considered historical fiction, but you've tied so much into it. It's amazing.
There's an enormous amount of research as there is in all of my historical novels.
Did you come to Seneca Falls to research some of the founding mothers?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, that's a fascinating museum. Now, I understand you want to read us another poem from The Crooked Inheritance. This one's called Buyer Beware.
Buyer Beware, yes. Hold on while I stumble around.
That's not the first line, right?
No. Buyer beware. If you subscribe to a magazine about dogs, it comes full of canine advice and pictures. Woof! If you buy a winter coat, you can reasonably count on it being warmer than your bare skin. If you buy a pig in a poke, it should oink at least. What do you get when you buy a war? Trillions of dollars in debt for one thing. Every grenade that explodes, ka-ching, ka-ching. Every ordnance, every vehicle, every plane. See the smoke rising? That's money on fire. That's your taxes at work. Does it help you? Is it better than repairing the local bridge you drive across every commuting morning? Is it better than putting kids through college so they aren't motivated to steal your car? Is it better than having health insurance that actually pays your hospital bills? Is it nicer than cleaning up the air you breathe or equipping miners so they don't die by the dozen down there in the smoky dark? What do you get when you buy a war? Security? Nah, the country you invade is chock full of people who now hate you. They're dying to invade you back. Shopping is our favorite entertainment. We go to the mall to wander and eyeball stuff, more stuff. We're stuffed with stuff. But at least you can wear that orange cashmere sweater. You can gobble that pizza. What do you get when you buy a war? Death. You get death retail and wholesale. You get death by the plane load. You get young death, old death, baby death. You get part death, limbs blown off, heads racked with shrapnel, spines torn apart and brains toasted, theirs and ours. You are delivered mistrust and hatred by the decade load. You purchase rape and pillage. You purchase torture and graft, bribery and looting. Your great-grandchildren will pay off the debt. Are you happy with your purchase of this war?
Have you read that at demonstrations?
I've read it all sorts of places.
Have you? Yeah, it's quite a powerful poem.
Yeah.
Well, at what point did you get absolutely disgusted by this war from the beginning?
Yes, before it happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Before it happened, I was convinced that that they were lying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so many were. So many of us were.
Yep. Didn't do any good. He was determined to go, and he went.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he didn't go, of course.
No, of course not. No. Now, your current collection, The Crooked Inheritance, is quite remarkable in that you've kept the same power and the same anger and the same way of articulating some of these subjects. Now,
also the same sweetness. There's a lot of love poetry.
Yes.
There's a lot of nature poetry. There's a section of poems that are used in Jewish ritual and so forth. And, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, it's a beautiful collection. Now, in one of the poems that I was particularly interested in is you talk about the invisibility of women over 50.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, to talk to us about that.
It was written for actually a scholarly journal about older women, a lot of research on older women. And I thought a poem, I asked them if they'd like a poem, and they did, so I wrote it for it. It's called I Met a Woman Who Wasn't There.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You want me to read it?
Yeah, I think that would be great.
The CIA should hire as spies only women over 50 because we are the truly invisible. We pass through checkpoints as if through spider webs with only a slime of derision. Watch television, go to the movies. You will see men of all ages, children, young females. Older men thrive with escorts half their age, but older women must die off en masse. In middle age, even with Botox, lip suction, facelifts, tummy tucks, whatever mad torture to the poor hard-working flesh surgeons can devise, we begin to vanish. Walk through a lobby, a crowded airport. Men and children will run into you in the obvious opinion you cannot possibly exist. We are inaudible, too. We speak and people turn away. Although we know much, our opinions are dust on the wind. Nobody collects or records them. We are this age's lepers, preferably penned out of sight in colonies of hunger. You have let yourself go. You have not refused the years politely, firmly, like an anorexic at a dinner party. History's warnings are etched in our bones. Like Cassandra, we've witnessed wars and famines and foresee that wind of ash blowing in. But to our prophecies, only our cats will listen.
Oh, that's very powerful.
Very true, unfortunately.
Yes, yeah. Now, women's lives have changed, you must admit, in the last 30 or 40 years, politically.
Yeah, we often have to work three jobs to make enough money to support our families, what we could do at part-time work in the 60s.
So you say...
The real wages of working people have diminished so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, some things we have made to be better, but a lot of things still, the rape statistics are still high. Every week, some husband comes home and shoots his family.
Yeah.
Or strangles them, or whatever he does. There's still enormous violence against women. You have only to listen to the lyrics of songs to understand how despised even young women are.
Mm-hmm. As a poet, what do you think about rap?
I think that I grew up in a black neighborhood, and I often felt at that time that things were a little better for black women in the community because there was enormous webs of support, and also there was an encouragement to be strong. Now I think the level of sexism has risen.
So you think our work is not done? Obviously, political...
Not done?
Yeah, but obviously political...
Have you been in an emergency ward lately? No, our work has barely begun.
Yeah, but political movements do not change hearts and minds is the problem as well, right?
Oh, we do change hearts and minds when we're able to get at people. But the media is so powerful now. It's so much more powerful than it was 40 years ago, 30 years ago, even 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And this culture of celebrity hasn't helped much.
It is absolutely crazy. I mean, what difference does it make to anybody you know, Paris Hilton stuck a phone book up her. What would we care? What impact does her life have on mine? Global warming impacts me far more. Yeah. Every time I walk by the ocean, every time I go outside, I feel it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I look at the statistics of skin cancer among young people. It's just nuts. We've been trained to be obsessed with people we will never met. It sort of reminds me, one time, let's see, some celebrity had died. I don't even remember who anymore. And a friend said to me, well, I care about as much as that as he would have cared about me.
That's very apropos commentary. Now, we only have about a minute and a half left. Can you talk to us about any future work that you might be working on right now?
No. No way.
Really?
I'm working on a first draft, and I'm lucky to talk about first drafts when you haven't written them.
You know, I've heard other writers say that. Is that a superstition, or do you think that's a fact?
I think it's a fact. I think you can talk it out. I also think you can get stuck saying you're doing something, and then you don't do it. It doesn't work.
Uh-huh. But you continue to write poetry, I take it.
All the time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you stop your life to write down what just happened the minute before?
No, the poems come from everything. They come from the paper. They come from conversations. They come from a rhythm that starts in your head. They come from an image. They come because you're asked to write a poem about something.
I would think those would be the hardest to write.
No, because you got a subject.
Hmm.
So, no, they're no harder to write than anything else.
Uh-huh. Well, March Percy, we have run out of time. I thank you so much for joining us. It's been an honor to talk to you, and may you continue to write so powerfully.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by Finger Lakes Arts Grants and Services. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.